Hello and welcome back to Coffee with Conservationists, the podcast where I sit down with people who dedicate their lives to researching, protecting and documenting nature. I talk to them about issues affecting wildlife, the climate and global biodiversity. We cover diverse topics within ecology, biology, storytelling, activism and much more. My coffee featured today is from Moon Roast Coffee. While many people think I've been doing this for years, I actually only started connecting coffees directly with my guests recently. I can't do this every single episode, but it just so happens that Moon Roast Coffee is based in Hampshire, as is my guest today. As usual, I'll be talking more about them at the end of the episode. In this episode, I speak to John Cranfield. John is a wildlife and ecological contractor specialising in reptile and amphibian surveys, habitat management, advice on mitigation projects, training and workshops, and much more. Hi, John. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me. I know it's been quite a faff trying to get us both at a time that works for us. It's not quite on the same par with the infamous Joe Harkness episode where we spent over a year trying to get in touch, I think. But it is close in the amount of times we've had to schedule and reschedule this, but I'm glad we have finally managed to make it work. So we'll start this off by getting to know you. Could you tell me a bit about yourself and where your kind of love and interest in nature and conservation first started?
Well, I suppose it first started at primary school, really. I really got into bird watching when I was young, before I was 10 years old. Really loved birds back then. Went bird watching with my brother and my dad. And so that's where my interest, always at home having chickens, rabbits and wildlife ponds and things like that, fish ponds and things at home. And I've always loved being out with nature and stuff and finding stuff. And then from that, we moved to a new house. And then I think when I was about 10 years old, my dad introduced me to my first slow worm. He gathered me around a corrugated piece of corrugated iron on the ground in a old horse field. And he sort of lifted, he sort of realized that there was slow worms under it. And he got me and my brother to either end of it and lifted it. And from that day on, I was just enthralled with reptiles and amphibians. And so all around my local area, I was looking for lizards and newts and frogs and things. And then it just became my hobby, really. And then as I went through college, I went and studied marine biology, came out of university, I managed to get a job as a wildlife consultant, as a newt specialist. I was working in Bedfordshire I was surveying the newt ponds and organizing emptying pitfall traps and things out of university and college. So that's what my first job was, really. And I was self-employed, and that's what I've been working in it ever since, really. During that same period, I got involved with amphibian reptile groups. So that's like a network of volunteer groups all across the UK. I was heavily involved in that, and I still am involved as a volunteer. But I also work as a professional wildlife consultant specializing in amphibians and reptiles.
Perfect. So you work with wildlife mitigation, or specifically reptile amphibian mitigation. For the layperson who doesn't know what that is or what you kind of consulting you do, when you say consulting, that can mean a whole range of things. What is it that takes up the most amount of your professional time?
Okay, well, I think people do know about great crested newts is one species that crops up in the media quite a bit.
Yes, I agree.
Recently, Boris Johnson had to, he had an objection to his swimming pool at a house in Oxfordshire, and that was because of great crested newts. So it does arise. So I'm basically an independent consultant that I will go out and in the past, we would go out and look at ponds and survey ponds to find the presence of great crested newts. And then we would advise on the best course of action for a development. So it's mostly development related. I have done conservation projects and other schemes which aren't directly development. And it's all around around those species, so our native amphibians and reptiles that are, there's strictly protected ones and there's partially protected species. And of course, in the planning system, you have to take steps to avoid, say, killing and injury of reptiles, so slow worms and things like that. And that's where I come in to advise people on how best to do that and devise strategies to conserve the animals that are found on land use change and development sites, basically. I mean, work has sort of dipped a little bit since the pandemic. I mostly go out and do survey work for reptiles mainly. Great crested newt work is sort of, for myself, is a bit, for the survey work, is a bit, it's more over to using technologies like DNA, looking for DNA in ponds. So I don't generally do many newt surveys specifically, but I do carry out certain types of licenses to help developers. When there's a low impact, for example, you can register a site and you can, it's more streamlined to, and then there's also negotiating with say what's known as a district level license, which is a more strategic license over a broader scale. And it's, guiding people through that sort of is it bureaucracy, red tape? It's meant to be more streamlined, but it's not always black and white. We can do things that avoid expensive delays to projects.
Yeah, that's a really great answer. And I think, a lot of people will be aware of great crested newts. They pop up in the media a lot. But
maybe not where you are, down in Cornwall.
Yeah, there's not so many.
Found down there.
We're a bit of an ecological niche down here. We've got a lot of weird and wacky species and a lot less of the more common ones as well.
Yeah.
I miss my red kites from my time growing up in Berkshire when I lived down here, as an example. But what a lot of people might not realize and unless they are really interested in herpetology or environmental science in general, is how important reptiles and amphibians are to their wider ecosystem and why we need to carry out these surveys and protect them. Could you kind of give a breakdown of why they're important species in their environment?
My dog has just come into the room. Hopefully he'll go out when it starts barking. Hopefully he's going to lay down. Yeah, cool. Sorry. it's a difficult one to answer, really. It's because I don't think people generally think, frogs in their pond. I mean, in their own value, people love things like frogs in garden ponds and stuff. It's, the British public really love their frogs and things like that. You can see that in the surveys that are undertaken and the amount of concern of online. We have a discussion group on Facebook which has got over 10,000 members on it, and they see a frog, they ask advice and things like that. So in terms of ecology and things like that, great crested newts, what's the point of a great crested newt? I mean, they are wonderful animals. When you see them, they're pretty big, they're 6 inches long. Lovely jagged crest. They look like a salamander. When you show children that, they just can't help being in awe of something which is relatively small, generally, but it, to them it's big. They provide a food source for many animals. So the larvae and the adults, they're things like herons and other animals will eat them. Even down to something like our venomous snake, the adder, actually they are in farming areas. Actually, there is sort of anecdotal information where people control adders on sites in the past and they're overrun with rodents and things like that. So they're pest controllers. So you could think about slow worms in a garden patch, a veg patch, eating slugs and snails and things like that. So it's not overly obvious why they're important, I suppose, to a lot of people, but they are part of the web of life, which helps with controlling pests and things like that. And they are declining because of loss of habitat and things like that. And it's just our, you know, our duty to try and help them. And the best way to help a lot of the species is to provide decent habitat for them to live in and to breed and to increase and spread through the landscape, etc. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, no, that answered that question great, perfectly. In the last very brief question on the consulting side of things, I've heard it's just all anecdotal evidence from my time working in environmental movements, or kind of, I used to do a lot of social media work and kind of fact checking and stuff. And I've heard that there's a lot of on a lot of big projects, big infrastructure projects, just to keep it simple, I'm not going to go into any specifics. There is a lot of ecological surveys carried out that are then ignored by the bodies that are controlling the projects, or they haven't done a survey properly at all. How much have you come across that in your line of work, that a big project hasn't done the proper surveys, or is either gone ahead with them and they're not quite done it right anyway?
Right. Okay. There is one big project that's in the news now, isn't there? Which I think, like with everything, especially big projects, there is, you know, scope for things being done poorly, or things that are done and they sort of get away with things. There are bad projects, there are good projects, you know, from very small projects all the way up to major infrastructure projects, there will be negatives and there will be positives out of some of these projects. You just got to give them time. There are examples that I know about, which aren't recognized in any sort of literature and things like that. It's, you know, my anecdotal stuff. I mean, I could hark on about my own projects and stuff and how successes that I've looked at, and you know, scientifically, we haven't looked at it scientifically, but the evidence, anecdotal evidence there that it seems to work. And there's always the horror stories of, you know, when you're driving along a motorway and you see thousands of meters of plastic fencing, and you see that there's like a half a meter of habitat left and the animals are just being chucked over the fence and stuff like that. So there's always those sort of projects. And then there are some trailblazing projects that sort of take it a bit further, and you're always constrained by the rules and regulations and what the government bodies will allow you to do, but it is important when you do mitigation, that mitigation means making it less severe, and then you have conservation and increasing the status of animals like great crested newts, for example. And it's this sort of narrative that all the work that's been done over the last 30, 40 years just hasn't helped, and there's a better way of doing things, which in some respects it is a good idea. But then I'm guessing even with those strategic sort of licenses and stuff like that, there will be successes and there will be failures. I think there was a quote from an ecologist that I know. We all know how to look after great crested newts, and it's build ponds and create woodlands, and newts will look after themselves. Some of the projects I've worked in, I've moved in a project in Essex. I've moved 2,000 great crested newts to a site which was less than a kilometre away. And I'm still managing that site now for the landowner. In 2018, we had a peak count of 225 adult newts, whereas the original site, we had a peak count of 50 in two ponds. But now we have six main breeding ponds, but we've added more to it over the last few years. So we've got a meta population of 18 ponds now. And it's that sort of action that's going to help species like great crested newts. And then you have the biodiversity that is comes in with those newts as well. There seems to be this sort of separation of protected species and biodiversity. And actually, when you create habitats for newts and other species, you need that biodiversity and habitat to support those species. So you don't know all the ins and outs of all the other species and things that are living there, but they do colonize newt ponds, for example, You put in scrapes that would enable frogs to breed, for example, or water beetles will come in. I mean, the project that I'm working on, we've got great silver water beetles that have colonized the site. An ecologist that we was working with us when we were moving the newts, he realized that there was a particular plant species in the ponds that were going to be destroyed, and he moved them over to the new newt ponds. And now we've increased the status of that plant species through the translocation. And actually that plant species was indicative of an important habitat in its own right. So I look back at the historic maps, and the ponds we destroyed were possibly 100 years old, based on the historic maps. So that we saved that species as well. So it's going beyond just the focus on the species. That's what people seem to focus on. It's all about Great Christian Newts. What about all the other species? And actually, there is a lot of, how would you describe it? It will be, I suppose, lots of collateral, if you could call it that. You create habitat, you allow woodland to develop, and species will colonize. And that's essentially what's happening in other projects, in other fields. So like things like rewilding and regenerative farming and stuff like that. But we can do that with protected species too.
Yeah. That was a really good answer, because obviously, as you know, from subtext, there's major projects that we could spend, you know, hours and hours going into the specifics ecologically. Yeah. But yeah, that was a really good, succinct answer for the time we have. And that kind of wraps up the consulting part of things. Onto the voluntary kind of on the ground conservation, your amphibian and reptile groups. How did you get involved in them, and what are they?
It was back in the 90s actually, and it was my where my parents used to live. It was my sort of childhood home, really, and we were on our estate was built in the 80s, and it was on essentially a water meadow, and then there were still parts of it that was still have fields and hedgerows, and there was a derelict car wreckers yard, which hadn't been used for years and years, and there was a artificial floodplain, and that's where I went and found some of these species. So great crested newts, smooth newts, frogs, toads, lizards and stuff. And actually the car wreckers yard became was up for development, and that's where I sort of, you know, was incensed, because there was all these slow worms and all this other, you know, all these animals that were there, and it was going to be developed. And that's where I got involved with amphibian reptile groups. So Frog Life at the time was the people that were organizing the ARGs. And the ARGs started I think the first ARGs were in Surrey or Sussex. There's a bit of a dispute when the first ARG was formed. And it was in about 1986 when they first started. And then eventually in the 90s, there was lots of groups, you know, either contacts or actual active groups across the country. And that's where the development got me involved with voluntary stuff, because I wasn't working, obviously. I was at college and things like that, and that was my interest, and I wanted to help the animals. And that's why I became involved with Essex ARG, established in the 90s back then. I moved away to university down to Hampshire, and I got involved with Hampshire Wildlife Trust and Hampshire ARG down here. And it's currently it's coordinated by a charitable organisation called ARG UK, which is the Amphibian Reptile Groups of the UK. And that's an organisation that coordinates all the local groups. So they're all networks, basically. And I'm in High ARG at the moment. And essentially, we are affiliated to the charitable organisation. So it's a network of interested people, groups across the whole country. You can go to their website and find your local, a local group if you want to join in. There's one in Cornwall, I believe. So it's on the ground. It's described as the grassroots of the conservation movement for amphibians and reptiles in the UK. You know, there's a whole host of resources that people can look download from the internet. Back then in the 90s, we had, you know, paper guides and stuff that we could flick through to go and find details of legislation, you know, what to do if you found an injured animal, you know, what to do in terms of a planning application threatening the site, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, I've just been doing that on and off, and I'm the county, well, I suppose I'm the recorder for the group in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. And we have a national recording system, which is called the Record Pool. And basically that anyone in the country can, if they see a frog or a toad somewhere on, you know, on holiday or, you know, even around their own homes and stuff like that, they can enter that information into the Record Pool. And that goes to the local ARGs to verify. And then that goes to local recording centres. And it's all to do with conserving the species. So recording animals, so species surveys on sites. We have habitat management. So we go out and my local churchyard, for example, we're managing the wild area there, which is full of lots and lots of slow worms in the centre of my town. That's a county wildlife site for slow worms. So we manage the chalk grassland and the bramble to keep it a bit open so then the animals can bask and things and prosper. We have public events. So we have in Hampshire, we have stalls with live animals. So I think recently was at Alice Holt Forest and we had tanks of a grass snake, slow worm, frogs and toads and things like that. And so people can come and see the animals, you know, face to face. And that's a really good way of educating people. But also people come to us and say, oh, you know, I think one person came to see the stall, went off to Alice Holt. There's Go Ape there and other things to do in Alice Holt. And they spotted a lizard and took a photograph of it and came back to us and said, oh, look, I found a lizard. Mm-hmm. So that was really good engagement. And it's really important that people realise that, well, one, the animals are there in the UK, and two, what to do if they find them. And if they really get interested, they can get involved with a local group. Because some people were visiting and they said, oh, you know, I manage a woodland somewhere in Warwickshire or somewhere. And I find lizards or I find toads. And so, well, you can report them on the app, you know. So it's, I mean, the Record Pool doesn't have a dedicated app, but it's, the website is HTML5 web or app compliant for smart devices.
Okay.
So if you've got internet connection, you can, it will display on your phone and you can use it to record stuff.
Perfect.
Sorry, I do go on.
No, that's all right. That's great. It's proper. I've been aware of. I haven't been involved in as much because mostly due to university commitments in a different field. Quite literally, different field somewhere sometimes.
What is your field? Is it?
So I studied marine and natural history photography. So I did actually photograph some reptiles and amphibians, but I kind of quickly specialized into more kind of human interest, kind of human nature stories, especially around different sites around my local area. So in first year I did kind of explore some of Craig's work, Cornwall Reptile Amphibian Group, and I like the acronym there, and
Craig, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't kind of get involved as much, but I've been aware of them for a while, and is from the outside at least, it seems like real, you know, as proper citizen science and getting everyone involved, accessible science as it can, which is always a positive thing.
And I suppose the marine turtles are few and far between off the Cornish coast.
Yeah, well, I didn't actually do the marine side of things. We do a marine environment module on our course, which I've just graduated from. So we study the marine environment and a bit more science and marine stories. My particular story was actually on a river connected to the Falmouth Harbour, but I can't dive, sadly, so I didn't do all the fancy underwater stuff as much as some other people. That was an optional part.
You didn't want to use a marine drone or a camera on a pole? Or
one day I would love to. One day it was. I've actually done a podcast episode on a scientist who uses drones for whale and dolphin conservation. So yeah, it's a fascinating. I'd love to get involved in that kind of side of things one day as an image maker and someone who loves that kind of thing. But
because I as part of my degree, I'm a marine biologist as a degree, and I spent 3 weeks or so out in Tenerife, and it was before the, you know, modern technology. We were using film cameras to photograph pilot whales, and looking at the negatives to determine individuals, so the negative of the fins and things and the markings. So, and it would have been amazing to have drones back then, but I'm guessing they're using drones now. But it's you know, and things like leatherback turtles, you see them off the Irish coast and the Cornish coast, and they use spotter planes, and you see turtles and sunfish and things at the surface of the water, which is pretty cool. So
yeah, there's so many, such a wide variety of things. But yeah, what I loved about Craig and then my further kind of interest in the wider groups is the how on the ground it is, and how on the podcast in general, we like to, especially if we're talking about quite a intensely academic subject like ecological consulting, I don't think is something that people would want to pick up a book in the library and start reading about particularly.
No.
I would, but that's just me, I'm strange. We like to keep it really fresh and accessible for anyone on the podcast. So my kind of final big question is, without your BSc, without kind of your formal scientific degree, do you think you'd be doing what you're doing today?
Oh, blimey. Well, that's the thing. It's, I had the BSc, obviously, on my CV and things like that, but it was my hobby, really, that and somehow I got an interview. I mean, my first job as a consultant was a horrendous job. It was a reptile job, and it was very much going through the motions, and I wasn't listened to, and I vowed never to be a consultant. The next year, I was called up by someone and said, oh, you know, we're looking for a new ecologist, and you were recommended by the biodiversity officer at the Wildlife Trust. And I went up to the meeting and I sat down with him, and it was in Peterborough, and he showed me his garden pond of literally full of frog spawn. It was during February time, I think, February, March time, and it was full of frogs. And he had 400 clumps of spawn in his garden pond. So it basically, and then, you know, I was my own boss. I was self-employed. What you say goes on site. If they don't do it, then I'll be on the phone and all that sort of stuff. So it changed my mind. And I had some job interviews prior to that and didn't get any work. So I just jumped back in. So what I'm saying is that it may not have been, I mean, the BSc obviously helped, but marine biology is not a big part of my work anymore. I would love to go back to it, and I do like the marine side of things. But I've worked terrestrially mostly. So how would you describe that? I mean, it's because my son is, you know, he's going to go to college and he'll be doing the T levels, which is very vocational rather than academic. And it's, yeah, so I think it's my hobby that became my job, basically. And I feel very fortunate with that. And I also like the challenge of working in that environment, because it's can be frustrating. You can pull your hair out over the, you know, the bureaucracy of stuff. But then you do have these projects that you have to pinch yourself that you're working on them, because they do work sometimes. I mean, I'm in a fortunate position that I can pick and choose work that I work on. So I don't have to do the big infrastructure projects unless they're close to home. And I have the same, you know, the same sort of, I don't know, the work they're doing is actually acceptable.
Yeah.
So I think it's, I don't know whether that answers the question or not, but
no, it does. I think it's, at the end of the day, what's important is that it was your kind of hobby and love of that group of creatures that got you into it more than, because what I'm trying to get at is that things like volunteering with your local reptile amphibian group can get you into this field of work if you if you want it, you don't have to have an academic qualification.
Essentially, during the 90s, you know, people were rallying against the consultancy industry, because, you know, amphibians and reptiles weren't really being considered until very late in the process. And a lot of people in the ARGs became consultants. And I probably was one of those, you know, I became a consultant. And in the future, I may, you know, decide to do something else and filmmaking and things like that. And then it becomes my hobby again. I mean, it's quite tough for me because a lot of the volunteering is either at the weekends or it's not during the week. And that's during the week suits me better.
Yeah.
Because I'm self-employed. I have family time at the weekend and things like that. So it would be nice to, you know, because I do the volunteering stuff as surveys and things as my work. So I sort of look at the recording side of things and encouraging people to report stuff. And I try to keep home as local to home as well. So my local area, I'm looking at herpetofauna and managing sites and giving talks at agricultural shows and things like that. It's interesting.
Yeah, perfect. Well, unfortunately, I've just seen the ticking clock that comes with having a free version of Zoom. I do miss my student license. I think the very last question, because we've only got about 4 minutes left on the clock, is how do you take your coffee?
Can I say flat white?
Yeah, with milk? You can say whatever you want.
Mostly I use an espresso machine here. But I just have a flat white foamed milk, basically, no sugar.
Yeah. So exactly the same answer as the last guest. So you're setting a trend. Well, they're setting a trend, clearly. All that's left to say is thank you so much. I'm really glad that we got to do this after so long. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, and I look forward to following along with what you do next.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
Thanks again to John for taking the time to speak to me today. You can find links to all of his work and also join your local amphibian and reptile group in the description below. My featured coffee today is from Moon Roast Coffee. Moon Roast is a Hampshire-based company, and they source their coffee from a hugely diverse range of countries. They encourage sustainable bean refills at their kiosk using your own container, offer coffee sacks, grounds, and chaff to gardeners and local community projects, and support the charity Cresca no Campo, a Brazilian charity providing a safe space for young children of farm employees. The link to their website is down below. Thank you all so much for listening. I've been your host, George Stephen Jones, and this is Coffee with Conservationists.